In a characteristic physicist arrogance, David asked me to give a blackboard 1 hour talk with an overview of the entire field of neuroscience. Tell us where the field is going. Now that's a typical approach of physicists or theoretical physicists. First of all, I want to begin by saying that I'm going to disappoint you, David. In contrast to physical systems, biological systems in general, and the brain in particular is such an enormously complex system with enormous diversity of subsystems, of levels, of descriptions, of types of problems that are involved in it, that's impossible to give such an overview in the blackboard 1 hour. So instead, I would like to focus on a small subset of issues and problems in the theory of the brain, which I believe, nevertheless, are very fundamental to the understanding of how the brain works, and at the same time they highlight the specific or special contribution of physicists or theoretical physicists to the subject. So in addition to give you a sense of these problems and possible solutions to these problems that that the community has been working on or dealing with, I would like also in my talk to give you a sense of how the field of theoretical neurophysics, so to speak, has transformed since the first ITP workshop in neural computation about 15 years ago. So many faults of the mind. A first order task of a physical theory of a system is to identify the low-lying or the ground state of the system, to identify their number, their structure, their properties, in particular the underlying symmetries which are involved in generating multiple ground states, whether this is discrete symmetries which are involved, continuous symmetries, etc. And these issues are important not only for understanding the static or the equilibrium properties of the systems, but also to understanding the dynamics or the long time dynamics. For instance, if there are discrete set of ground states and which are generated by, for instance, breaking of discrete symmetry, then long-time dynamics will typically be dominated by hopping over barriers or tunneling over barriers, separating those states. If continuous symmetries, broken symmetries are involved, and there is a continuum manifold of ground state, then the long-time dynamics may typically involve long wavelength fluctuations, which tend to restore the broken symmetry. So an analogous approach I would like to advertise for addressing the dynamics of the brain or the dynamics of local neural systems in the brain, namely understanding the stable states, understanding the long-term dynamics of those systems which are dominated by around those stable states, and what are the functional relevance of this long-time dynamics and those manifolds of stable states. But before talking about the brain and concrete systems about the brain, I would like to spend a few minutes talking about the mind, or rather perception. So let me then talk about manifolds in perceptual phase space. Now, when we formulate a theory of perception, how our perceptual system works, there is a low-level task which is detect the signals, the sensory data. But beyond this task, what perception involves with is categorizing, classifying, recognizing object, etc. And in an abstract notion, one can think about perception that what it does, it takes the sensory phase space and simply dissects it into regions. And we can think about each region as correspond to a given object. So object A, B, C, D, etc. So perception is organizing the phase space of the sensory world into those subregions, which are the objects of concepts or other perceptual classification. And a very fundamental issue in the theory of perception in general, in pattern recognition, is what is the structure of those regions? What is the underlying metric? What is the geometry of the boundaries? How do you manipulate those? How you modify those boundaries by learning? How you access them, etc. And there are essentially several simple models of how this sensory space is naturally dissected or organized. One of them is focusing on elementary states in this high-dimensional space, which are sort of clusters. So you think about cluster centers, you think about a discrete set of points around which you draw balls or spheres. This discrete set of points are the elementary states upon which perception works. So in a very simplified fashion, you can think about this one cluster signifies information about one object, etc. A tremendous amount of theoretical and applied research has been devoted to this approach to sensory processing, pattern recognition, and so on. For instance, clustering, vector quantization, associative memory, various methods of template matching, all sort of have this metaphor in mind, that you have you really compress the system into a discrete set of states, of templates or prototypes. You typically think about the radii of these spheres as essentially noise or distortions which are not significant, you classify or categorize objects according to where they lie in this kind of organization of the space. Now, this kind of discrete tessellation of the input space is very efficient, very useful for compression of information, for data processing, but has severe limitation in modeling perception and in dealing with real world data, like visual objects, auditory objects like speech recognition, etc. And the reason being that there is enormous variability in the nature of the data, sensory data, which in our perceptual mechanism we are able to characterize or categorize as the same object. So it's inconceivable that we can think about all instances which correspond to a given object to be simply lying within a small sphere around some template. And this enormous variability to capture it, evidently we have to go to a different geometry. There is of course a problem of overlap, and this is being dealt by a sort of what is called the soft clustering or probabilistic approach, where you have ambiguity in the boundaries between the spheres. So there is a whole field of hard clustering versus soft clustering and milling with temperature and so on, that are all issues, important issues which are dealt with. But what I want to focus is the basic geometry, the basic structure of having some discrete set of states and spheres around them is simply inappropriate for many interesting tasks. If you think about an object and you distort it, you translate it, you rotate it, you scale it, and so on, all these different versions or realization of the same object are not lying here, like some of them here and some of them there and so on. So we need a different geometry of manifolds correspond to the entities of the perceptual world. And okay, there's another simple geometry or simple set of models, and this is models which are all correspond to some sort of linear manifold or submanifolds. So in that, in this set of models, you take the sensory data and you simply draw hyperspaces or lines or hyperplanes in this high dimensional data, and here you think about the axis in orthogonal to this hyperplane, so this low dimensional linear object, as again measuring or reflecting some noise or insignificant distortion similar to this spheres. But now here you have an extended axis of variation, which are the significant variability, capture some of the significant variability corresponding to enormous variability of realizations of the same object. You can think about different object or different classes of object as being represented by different hyperplanes in this enormous high dimensional space. And this also has a set of a very successful models and beautiful theories and also beautiful applications. I'll come to that. So for those of you that know what principal component analysis, PCA, is, So if I think about sensory data, this can be thousands and so on. And if you think about here, about let's say a picture that you try of an object that you try to reduce it to some low dimension, then you can think about maybe thousands of pixels, and you reduce it to some low dimensional consisting of tens of dimensions, these low dimensional hyperplanes. Okay. So it's very successful. Yes. Yeah, so the typical distance is Euclidean distance in both cases, although there are of course variations on that as well. Right. But they are connected in the sense that they lie on a submanifold course representing the same object or the same class of object. Right. Now, you can apply the whole linear algebra, metric theory to your advantage. A linear system has very nice simple dynamics that you can sort of implement on, and so on and so forth. So that's a very nice set of methods that has classical methods of applying to pattern recognition and to models of perception. But obviously, it has its own limitations. And reality is somewhere in between. For instance, simply think about rotation of an object. Then it's not going to lie on a linear manifold. It's going to be lying in some curved closed line, some string, closed string. I don't know if it's heterotic or something else. So in general, you can think about a more general picture where you have some smooth, locally smooth manifolds but are more complicated objects than just discrete points or linear manifolds. And they perhaps will correspond to a more realistic view of the way perception organizes input space. So this will be some nonlinear smooth manifold. Now, of course, symmetries or global symmetries will give rise to such manifolds. But global symmetries are easy to account for. We know what of them with translation, rotation, but there are also scales and there are also local distortions. So we'll talk about something which is more local symmetries, and you know, maybe gauge symmetries are more appropriate. And in general, we don't understand. There is very poor understanding of the full structure of those manifolds that correspond to invariant object recognition. And there is a very important and interesting theoretical work and also algorithmic work in trying to learn those manifolds, at the boundaries of those manifolds. And those of us that follow the field of learning theory know that this is a central focus of current research in learning theory. Okay, so what I want to now to do is to take this structure and now to impose it inside the brain. So now we're talking about manifolds, but brain state manifolds. And my point is that by thinking about how the brain actually can realize such an operation, such an organization of states, we have to think about the brain as a concrete dynamical system, and this imposes severe and important constraints on what kind of structure can naturally appear. And a lot of research in recent years have been devoted in understanding how manifold of such states can be realized by the actual states of a dynamical system such as the brain or subsystems in the brain.
I'm wondering if you're modeling as well the context from which an object is seen, because I'm sure that most of the time when we recognize something, we're helped a lot by the fact that some other objects are around the object that we're trying to recognize.
Yeah.
So that people have context.
Right. Right, there will be another, if you're asking about other objects? I didn't understand the question.
I guess the question is, you seem to be talking about recognizing an individual object.
Yeah, there will be another object here. There will be another object here.
You recognize it. This more easily
yeah.
when it's on the table. So you recognize
it. I'm recognizing an object as an object regardless of its position, rotation, scale, distortion, and so on. Although I don't lose the information about these degrees of freedom. So it's not a matter of forgetting those other variables, but I'm nevertheless able to recognize this as the same object.
But isn't the context very important?
Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, some, I might recognize something as a candle because I know that it's standing on a table.
Okay, I mean that's, I completely agree, that's a starting point, I think. And I'm not going to discuss any further a more developed theory of that. Obviously, the question of even if they exist, these entities, how you access them has a lot to do with the issue of context. Okay, so how, if there is an instance, how the system actually knows on which on which manifold it lies in order to actually make a decision and so on. But I don't want to say further anything about perception, about categorization and so on. I want just to address the issue how a dynamical system such as the brain can organize its states in one of these fashions. And what is the reason to actually speculate or hypothesize that it does it, except for the top level, high level theory of pattern recognition, perception that I sort of sketched here. Okay, so when I think about the brain, okay, I have to first of all identify what are these elementary states, whether they are sort of these discrete centers of the cluster, these prototypes, or whether they are the manifold of states. What does it mean that a dynamical system such a brain has this manifold of states? What is the dynamical signature of these states? And almost all of us have been working with the fundamental hypothesis, which I'll call the attractor hypothesis. Which identifies those states or manifold of states as the stable states of the dynamical system. So now, instead of thinking about the sensory data and organizing it in an abstract fashion, well, now we think about the phase space of a dynamical system, and we're now addressing the issue of the structure of its attractor state, of it is low line, it's sort of stable state of the system. Okay, so immediately when we think about, when we translate this into the realm of dynamics, there are very major problems that sort of elementary comes about. So, for instance, if we think about a dynamical system that potentially has discrete sets of stable states, of ground states, what kind of mechanism we know that will give rise to that? So I already mentioned if there is an underlying symmetry or discrete symmetry, so that's a natural way of generating a discrete set of ground states. However, the question is, are these discrete sets of ground states, are these symmetries realized in the brain? What is the symmetry which corresponds to those? Now, nevertheless, if we think about non-equilibrium physics, about dynamical system in general, out of equilibrium, we know that the situation is not so difficult, because to get multi-stable, a set of multi-stable states, which are not necessarily degenerate ground state, is not so difficult. It's actually sort of generic in a nonlinear system, or structurally stable, to be more specific. In other words, you don't have to fine-tune too much your parameters of the system in order to have a dynamical system which have multi-stability, multiple stable states, or multiple attractors. So, in some sense, to realize this by a nonlinear dynamical system such as the nervous system is not so difficult. However, when we go to try, when we expand our repertoire of manifold of states to continuum manifolds, it's much more difficult. It's much more difficult because the natural way in which we know how to do it in physics is by invoking continuous symmetry, or breaking of continuous symmetry. And in general, it's hard to find the corresponding, or it's challenging to find what is the corresponding symmetries that we are talking about when we'll attempt to construct such manifolds of states in the neural dynamics. So there are you need much more fine-tuning in order to generate dynamical systems which have continuous manifolds of ground state, or any stable continuous manifold of stable state in contrast to discrete state. Okay. So let me then first of all say a few words about discrete states in the context of a concrete system in the brain, and then move on to the continuous manifold. So let me first of all remind you that the canonical Hopfield memory model for memory, which occupied much of our attention in the first ITP workshop on world computation, and this is a model for memory, associative memory, and now here we think about the space which I'm drawing is the I have a neural network, I have some, again, high dimensional phase space of the instantaneous state of the neural network, and the idea is that by appropriate choice of the connections between the neurons, one can design the system in such a way that the memories will be a discrete set of memories will be the ground states or the stable states of the system. And in those days, we were occupied or preoccupied by issues of capacity, aspects of learning, and many beautiful abstract questions, which essentially involved in how many those states can be embedded in a given network. Are there spurious states which appear together with those memory states, which prevent an efficient accessibility, and so on and so forth. But during the course of years, when we actually try to apply this notion that memories should be thought of as an attractors of the neural dynamics to actual neural systems, experimentally observed neural systems, an entire set of problems appeared. And I would like to show you one major problem which appeared, which took us away from all these nice spinglass capacity calculations and forced us to think much more seriously about the reality of the brain and the difficulties and the constraints that the architecture and the dynamics of neural systems impose on these nice ideas. And here's a particular problem. If we think about how a particular memory system in the brain works, what one finds is that indeed, when the system is triggered by some sensory input, it goes into a stable state for a while, which one can think of as a particular attractor or fixed point corresponding to some memorized configuration. If another input is coming, then the system triggers the system transiently to move into another state, which corresponds to another memorized object. However, the question is, what happens during those episodes? What happens to the system when it's not queried for any memory? Now, if you take a naive system like that, what happens? The system will just lay idly in one of those memory states until it kicked out of it and it's moved to another memory state. Now, this is not the reality of the brain. Those systems are universally have some, so to speak, vacuum state, if you want, a quiet state or an idle state, so to speak, in the middle, where all the neurons are essentially firing at some low level and some spontaneous background activity, and then universally observed in sort of high-order associative memory types areas of cortex. So what you have is a slight modification of the picture. You have this vacuum or background state where the system likes to be in, and then when there is an episodic event of memory, what happens is that the system is kicked out of this state into one of those states. Okay. So from an abstract point of view, that's not enormous difficulty. You just have to make the connections in such a way that there isn't one more state, stable state, and this is your vacuum state or your spontaneous background state, which will be stable together with the other memory state. The difficulty lies in the fact that if you compare the pattern of this state to the pattern of those memory states, you find they are not very different. In other words, if you try to model such a system, what you will find is that nearby state, in order to stabilize different states, they have to be sufficiently apart from each other. Typically, what you have is states which are separated by barriers, and those will be the two degenerate or multiply stable states. But the reality is that if you look at those memory states, the change in activity that is induced by the memory is very close to the, is not so far, is essentially a minor modification or perturbation on the ground state, on this vacuum or spontaneous state. So what you actually have is a state where you have two very close to each other, two states which are multiple states which are rather close to each other, and both are stable. So what you end up, what we ended up very quickly, is facing a severe problem which we are now calling the problem of persistence of activity, or persistent state of activity. It's a universal problem. That's what's nice about it, because you see this in many, many high-order areas in cortex, that you have a neural system which has a sort of a background state, and when it gets kicked into an operation in a storing of memory, or recall of memory rather than recall of memory, what you have is some neurons change their activity, some neurons increase their activity, some neurons decrease their activity, but the overall global change is not big. So how do we get nearby states to prevent from merging and distorting the whole structure? So what I'm claiming is that these distances in phase space, the reality is that these distances are small. This is the question of, excuse me?
What's a metric?
And here the metric is the natural metric for the dynamics, namely just the scalar product of the differences. Right, exactly. That's the natural metric as far as we understand from that is relevant to the neural dynamics.
So something like a humming distance for a brain.
Exactly. And it turns out that a lot of energy and ingenuity has been devoted by the community in trying to provide mechanisms that will make such a state, such a system robust, that you have this background state together with nearby memory states stable. Do you require fine-tuning of connection to be near a second-order phase transition where you have several states which are close to each other but still are nevertheless distinct and stable? Or you have some machinery in the hardware of the nervous system which takes care of it? There's a whole repertoire of models and ideas about it, and I think some of it will be discussed by Carsten Chow tomorrow in our seminar. But this is one set of problems, and it's interesting, before I leave this simple, discrete organization, before I leave it, I just want to mention, again, to emphasize what happens to the research program in associative memory. What happens to it as far as the theoretical physics community is concerned, I believe, is that it has redefined the problem and redefine the problem in context of facing the reality of the brain. And I think that's what the enormous transformation of the field has been facing also in other areas of theoretical research. In trying to take some bold and global and abstract ideas and thinking more seriously about how they are implemented in the brain, we face with problems which are fundamental to the understanding of the brain, because they are universal, they are robust, these phenomena are robust. You cannot avoid addressing it. And in this we have to come with the more concrete models which have very specific predictions about the biology, and which means that we are now defining the playground where both experimental and theoretical research is being engaged in trying to address the specific mechanisms that are needed in order to take this abstract idea and to formulate it as a valid hypothesis for a concrete brain system.
Could I ask you?
Yeah.
Extension of my question. I mean, so is the problem stability of these states which have some memory, or is the problem that there are plenty of other states which would be very different from vacuum states, which don't seem to be used for anything?
No, the simple problem, the simplest problem starts with stabilizing those pairs of nearby states. Even before thinking about the Hopfield kind of problem of spurious state and so on, if you think about the natural non-linearities of neural dynamics, the simple elements that goes into the dynamics, you find it's very natural to separate state into being far away from each other. So if you have this vacuum state, those memory states will have a significant fraction of neurons being highly active, firing at saturation, and that's what you don't find in the brain. Okay, so just to have this kind of organization without even thinking about spurious states is a very interesting and fundamental problem. Until we settle this issue, all these notions about memory states and spurious states and capacity are completely irrelevant, because they don't address the reality of how the brain works. Okay, let me now move to this kind of these types of manifold.
Can it just be something that is, you know, isn't solved, is just laid onto the network, some kind of turn-off switch, external force that is then removed?
It is possible. The problem, part of the problem in addressing this issue is that those systems are sufficiently high level in the cortex that we don't fully understand or very little notion of what the actual input is. So what we know is that the sensory input which triggers those transition to those states is transient. Okay, and so there is a few milliseconds of input, and maybe in sensory periphery it persists for 100 milliseconds, and then it's turned off, and then you have a persistent state in those systems which stays for many seconds, or several seconds. Okay, so there's always a possibility that there is another input which comes, which does it. It's a hidden input. We always have this danger, a rescue and a danger, that the solution is somewhere else, beyond, one step beyond your electrode, as we used to say. That's a problem. And this is partially the reason why a center of mass of research has moved away from high-level systems like memory systems and more to sensory and motor control systems, where you have much better idea about what their input is and what their and sometimes also what their output is. Okay, so I mentioned here a discrete structure of manifolds and linear manifolds. So the question is, we have any reason to suspect that you have also in the brain, as a low-lying state or a manifold of stable states, a linear manifold? And the answer is yes. And this brings me to the address fundamental issues in motor control. And so we all know that we are easily easily stabilize our posture. And we gracefully change our posture from one position to another. So what does it mean that we can maintain the posture of the body or posture of the limb? Obviously, the biomechanics of the skeleton, muscles, and so on has some equilibrium, some rest state, some well-defined fixed point. Maybe if it's nonlinear, we'll have several such discrete rest states. Nevertheless, we are changing continuously our posture, and without any difficulty in maintaining them stable for a long time. So obviously this is maintained, this postural stability is maintained by tonic activity, by persistent activity of neural signals to the muscles, which change their properties and reorganize their equilibrium state. So the problem is to understand the source of those tonic signals, neural signals, which are capable of maintaining and changing the posture. Now, naively you would think it's not a problem because there are some long loops from sensory information back to motor feedback, and these long loops have delays, and those delays provide the long dynamics which is needed for this stability. However, it's a fact that you can actually cut off all sensory feedback and still maintain postural stability. So this actually brings us to the idea that there must be centrally generated neural signal, a neural system which is capable of generating signals which are on one hand side stable for a long period of time, and on the other hand side they can change continuously their configuration, and thereby changing modifying our postural position. And it's such an elementary and primitive sort of question, it's very striking to realize that it's complete mystery. What are the sources of those signals and what maintain their stability? Now, the problem lies in the fact that the microscopic dynamic timescale of a neuron is of the order of 1 to 10 milliseconds, including synaptic integration, of the order of tens of milliseconds, maybe 100 milliseconds. But we are talking about many seconds of long timescales that system is stable. So what what endows the system with such stability? So obviously the natural hypothesis would be that there is a whole manifold of stable states which the network as a cooperative system is generating, and those manifolds then are the states which can be very long-lived. So although the microscopic time scale is very small, you go to a very long time scale if you move around those marginal directions in phase space. So can be more concrete and define a particular system where we can actually identify the nuclei in the brain that actually generate those signals, understand their function, and try to model it. And the answer to that is, and this will be a linear manifold, is the system that is in charge of controlling eye position. And I emphasize, it's a nice system, but it's actually is an example of the broader issue of motor control. So if you look at the system that control the eye position, it's again, you have the same phenomenon, that you are able to stabilize the gaze over a long period of time, of tens of seconds, even in the dark, where you don't have any visual input and so on and so forth, without any sensory feedback. So the original gaze or eye position is kept stable for a long period of time. Now, if you think about the organization of the system, you have the motor plant in the engineering language, which goes into the eye or eye muscles, and they are simply they are in charge of generating the appropriate command. So if I translating the neural command into neural command which appropriate to the muscles, but then there is a system upstream which is called the neural integrator, for reasons which I'll explain in a moment, which actually is known to be in charge of maintaining this gaze stability. What does it mean? You have a collection of neurons here where the output is essentially, if I denote by eye position the E, then the output of this neural integrator is the command which is appropriate for maintaining the eye position in a given position, let's say horizontal position in terms of angles. Let me mention it here. So if you look inside this system, what you find is that if you draw different eye positions and neural activity, and you look at a record from single units, you find that one unit will have a linear, up to a threshold, relation between activity of a single neuron and eye position. Another neuron will have another a linear relation, and so on. So you have a whole population of neurons which their activity simply is denoted, is coded by a single variable, which is simply the eye position relative to the navel, to the middle. So without even thinking about the dynamics, the mechanism generates it. Okay, what if I think about the underlying geometry, what it means that if I think about the phase space, essentially, if I draw a vertical section for each eye position corresponds a point along a line in this high dimensional space where all these stable states live. So we have a high dimensional neural network which somehow is managed to generate those persistent states which are all lie in a linear manifold, essentially in a line. And in our language, naturally call them line attractor. So we have a line attractor out of the network dynamics, and the natural question is, what is the mechanism that generates it? But before that, let me address the issue why they are called neural integrator. And the answer is that the role of the system is not only to stabilize the gaze, but actually to stabilize retinal image, to stabilize the image of on the retina. So when we move our head, then this system is generating a command for rotating the eyes in opposite direction, so to compensate for head movement. So actually the full diagram of the system is that there is the vestibular system here, which generates input, which is head velocity, angular velocity. And this this input, you can think about it as a velocity, as a negative velocity signal for the integrator, and somehow the dynamics here has to integrate this signal of velocity into a position. And when we rotate smoothly our head, this output of the system continuously generates the appropriate compensatory signal, which essentially means that what you have is, if you cut off this input, if there is no rotation of the head, you just have a stable and a linear set of stable states. If you generate, if you get a velocity signal, then you just move along this line with the appropriate velocity signal.
Could you say again why it's linear? Is that just because you're only considering 1 degree of freedom as far as the rotation of the head is concerned?
It's linear. It's linear because it's a fact, an experimental fact that it's linear. It doesn't have to be linear, but it's experimental fact that if you draw here the eye position in angles, the linear, the activity as a function of this eye position is linear up to a threshold. So it's not something which I would hypothesize to begin with, but I'm saying this is a matter of fact that it's almost linear. So you have a linear change of activities with this coordinate. It doesn't have to be. Of course, it's not a full rotation, so there's no problem of linearity, because we're talking about restricted angle, right? So we don't fully rotate our eyes, okay? But I'm saying it could have substantial non-linearity, but first of all, it's a matter of fact that it's linear. Now, whether this linearity is important or not, I'll come to the mechanism, and I'll convince you that it's potentially important. But first of all, it's experimental fact that you have this linearity. So I would claim that looking, without even thinking about mechanism, just looking at how the system represent or respond or is active corresponding to an eye position simply enforces you the idea that you have this linear manifold of stable state. And furthermore, that when you have a velocity signal, the system is capable of integrating the velocity signal with very little correction or distortion, error or distortion, in order to move along this line. So you have movement along this manifold with appropriate velocity signal. Now, to get an integrator from engineering point of view, again, it's trivial. Mathematically, just write an integral, and engineers have beautiful ways of having capacitors and feedback error corrections and so on. It's an elementary job in engineering. It turns out to be a fundamental and serious problem in understanding how a neural system can integrate, because integration means that the leak or the time constant involved in spanning the memory of the system is enormous compared to the microscopic time constant. So again, the question is, having this structure, what is now the mechanism of generating this structure? So let me show you one possible mechanism that can generate such a structure. It's sort of trivial, but it gives you again a taste of how modeling approaches these kind of problems. So taking into account, assuming this is a fact, this experimental fact, how a neural dynamics, cooperative neural dynamics, can generate such a linear manifold of stable state. Okay. So here is a simple example. Let me write down simply the Hamiltonian of the system. So I denote by vector S the states of all the neurons from 1 to n. And let me write down a simple Hamiltonian for the system, Sijijsj. And let me then, which I can also write as diagonalize this matrix and write it as the in eigenvalue space of the interactions. So now S mu are the corresponding projection of the state of the neuron onto the appropriate eigenvector, simple diagonalizing the Hamiltonian of the system. Now all what I need is then to assume that J1, let's say, the first mode is zero, and J mu are all positive from mu bigger than one. So what corresponds to simply saying that the Hamiltonian of the system is completely invariant to changing the state of the system in a particular direction in phase space. A very trivial mechanism of doing that. Which means, so if I denote by S1, this singular, the vector S1 as the eigenmode, the singular eigenmode, then obviously any state of the system which has some arbitrary amplitude along the direction of this eigenstate will be a zero energy state of the system. And this E can be arbitrary. And therefore you have simply line of states which are the zero or the ground state of the system, sort of a trivial way of generating those linear manifolds. And you can easily generalize it to a two-dimensional, three-dimensional manifold by simply having the appropriate singularity of more modes in your interaction matrix. Okay, what are the problems with this hypothesis? So first of all, before talking about the problems, how can I explain integration using this model? Okay, that's a very a simple way, is assuming that I have the external field will be, if I think about the dynamics of the system, I'll have S dot equals to the gradient of the Hamiltonian with respect to this energy, but then I can add also time-dependent external field, and I'm going to assume that it has this form, which is plus or minus some velocity signal, so all what I have to assume is that the spatial structure of the external input, this input, correspond to the singular mode. And if you have this structure, it's easy to see that the dynamics along this mode will simply be the integral of the external input times this mode S of t, times this spatial mode. So in other words, one generates a long time in the system by having a singular mode in the Hamiltonian, thus enabling the system to generate a line of stable states and moving along the line by integrating a velocity signal. Okay. Now, there are two severe problems with this hypothesis. One problem is it requires fine-tuning. It requires designing the interaction in such a way that one of the modes will be zero. So, and that's again puts a severe constraints about the system. The system cannot be small enough, because the smaller the system is, the more sensitivity to a small perturbation of each of the connections in the system that generate the spectrum. Okay, so if the system is large enough, it may be more robust to change to small perturbations in the connections. If the system is small, the smaller the system is, the less robust it is. So one has to perhaps invoke a learning mechanism which constantly, continuously maintain the system in its marginality by compensating for errors and modifications. Another severe problem has to do with the linearity. I sort of assumes that the neural states are linear, so nothing has, I didn't invoke any linearity. Now the problem is that neural dynamics has important nonlinearity in it. And once you add some nonlinearity, once you add into the dynamics some local nonlinearity, which has some local potential with some nonlinearity, you not only distort this structure from being linear to nonlinear, which is a minor problem, but the most severe problem, that typical local nonlinearity destroys the structure or the degenerate structure completely and generates a set of small number of points. So this neural integrator model has non-robustness, first of all in the design of the interaction matrix, and secondly in having to suppress the effect of nonlinearities. Both can be overcome by other mechanisms, but you need to hypothesize this other mechanism to overcome this. And again, the same line of research has developed here to take this abstract idea into a concrete model for this particular system of the neural integrator for the eye for the control of eye movement require to make a very specific assumptions about mechanisms that overcome these problems, and some of them are experimentally testable. What is nice about this particular system that the VOR system, the vestibular ocular reflex system, which I'm describing here, exists universally across the animal kingdom, from goldfish to humans, and therefore some of these systems are more easily accessible to experimental tests. And let me then mention as a paradigm for this kind of curved manifold, let me mention symmetries. So how can symmetries be embedded in the neural dynamics, and what are problems that can arise from that? And the issue of symmetries came about by thinking about the most fundamental, or I wouldn't say fundamental, but the most elementary operation of what the visual cortex is doing with a visual image. So there is a very important retinal processing, there is very important thalamic processing of visual image, but they all correspond to sort of local spherical processing of the light pattern that impinge on their circular receptive field. When you look at the first stage of cortical processing of visual information, you find orientation selectivity. So what you find is that neurons, all of a sudden, so to speak, it doesn't appear before that, if you change the orientation of the bar or grating or image, visual image that lie in the receptive field, and you plot their activity, you find that they have a tuning, orientation tuning. So this is the activity of a given neuron. And this is the angle of the external angle of a stimulus. You find orientation tuning. Neurons prefer a certain orientation over the others. And that's sort of the first non-trivial feature selectivity that you see in cortex. Later on, or at the same time, you see perhaps direction selectivity. Later on, you see more complex feature selectivity. But sort of the first feature selectivity that you see in visual cortex is orientation selectivity. And that's surprising sometimes, because if you look at some of these neurons are relatively some of them are relatively sharp, like within 30 degrees of the preferred orientation, they simply shut off. Not all of them, many of them are body tuned, but there's a significant fraction of neurons that are sharply tuned to orientation. And given the fact that the previous stage is not selective to orientation, the question is naturally, what is the origin of this breaking of symmetry, of this in the response of the neurons?
Is the orientation selectivity relative or absolute? In other words, does it depend on whether these fringes are on the board, or what happens when I turn my head?
No. That's relative to retina.
Relative to retina.
I mean, there are recent experiments which show that there is some effect already in primary visual cortex of coordinate transformation, stuff like that. But I'm talking about simple the first approximations relative to retina. Okay, so now you can always and there is a to make the story to make a short brief story there is indication that the input, if I look at that particular neuron, the input to this neuron in terms of if I draw again, the input is a function of, so this is the output of the neuron, and I'm drawing the input to the neuron. So although the neuron receives input from neurons in the previous stage, each of which is completely oblivious to the orientation, but you can arrange geometrically a series of neurons in the previous stage in such a way that the overall input to a given neuron will have bias towards orientation. And that's a canonical feedforward model of orientation selectivity. So if you put realistic numbers and so on, you find that indeed the input, the total input to the neuron given the spatial filter of the arrangements of the inputs to it, have some bias to orientation. But if you put realistic numbers, you find that the inputs to the neurons typically are very broad, are much broader than when you look at the output. The input from the previous state much broader when you look at the output of neurons. Furthermore, if you change the contrast of the visual stimulus, if you increase the intensity of the stimulus without changing the orientation, what you find is that this profile goes up. And now there is a serious problem, because if this is the case, then you can think, okay, let me assume that the output of the neuron simply take the input and thresholds it. And then if the threshold is high enough, you are going to see a relatively sharp tuning. The problem with this picture is that if you then increase the contrast of the stimulus, you will find that the tuning broadens. And it's again a very well-known fact, experimental fact, that this doesn't happen, that there is a contrast invariance of orientation tuning. So if I draw here again the output of the neuron and orientation tuned, if I increase the contrast of the stimulus, the shape doesn't change. And again, interesting invariance and non-trivial invariance in the operation of cortex, whereby the way the angle is encoded is by shifting the activity along this axis. The way contrast is encoded is by increasing, multiplying the whole shape of tuning upwards. So this is what is known as contrast invariance of orientation tuning. And has been kind of a puzzle. Both the sharp orientation tuning and its contrast invariance has been a puzzle for a very long time. And thinking about this problem, one way of understanding this had to do with thinking not only about the feedforward input to the cortex, but also about the local cortical circuit, and to describe it briefly, think about again the cortical network that is involved in processing this angle information. If I call this the external angle, we think about it as organized functionally in a ring, where each axis, each point in the ring correspond to the preferred angle of the neuron. So functionally, we think about neurons lying on a ring. Each of these neurons receives input, which has this form, but now we are hypothesizing that the interactions between neuron and cortex are spatially modulated by their functional distance. So we take the cortical space, the cortical neurons, and we functionally organize them in a ring, and we have what we call a ring model. And then the crucial question is, if you have two neurons, how the interaction, the cortical interaction between the two neurons depend on their spatial or functional distance, namely their coordinate in this functional space of angles. And what one finds is, not surprisingly, that if the interaction has this Mexican hat shape, namely that nearby neurons excite each other and neurons which are orthogonal to each other in angle space inhibit each other, if this spatial modulation is strong enough, what you find is that the intrinsic stable state of this network, of the cortical visual network, is not a homogeneous state, but rather a whole manifold of states which lie in the ring. So if I think about this ring as representing my neural population, then if the interactions are sufficiently modulated, you have a whole set of activities, localized activities, all of them are stable, are equally stable along the ring. So we have now an example of a ring attractor. So here the idea is that we invoke or we hypothesize a spatial or translational symmetry along the ring, this functional axis in cortex with which the interactions obey. So it turns out that if you assume that this mechanism, then first of all you get a very, you can get sharp tuning of orientation of orientation simply because the orientation degree of orientation tuning is determined by cortical interactions rather than the precise shape of input. Furthermore, if you increase the contrast of the input, what you have is to take this state, the cortical state, and you scale it up if the system is not too nonlinear. So you can explain both sharp orientation tuning and both contrast invariance by assuming these marginal states, which are which make the structure of a ring attractor. Now, again, there are difficulties in making this hypothesis, and one major difficulty is the assumption that the simple the system obeys this underlying symmetry. So connections between two neurons have to be only a function of the distance between the difference in their preferred orientation rather than other aspects. You have to assume that all the neurons are equally represent, all the angles are equally represented in the system and so on. So you have to assume that there is an underlying continuous symmetry which is broken spontaneously, so to speak, and generate this ring of states. Again, you can compensate for some of these problems by assuming a learning which will take, which will can correct for distortions, for anisotropies, and so on. But it's again highly non-trivial. Now, the question whether orientation selectivity is mediated by such an attractor is highly controversial. This hypothesis, and it may likely be that it's too much to demand from such a primitive action of orientation selectivity to rely on such a fancy mechanism. However, this idea of having such a ring structure, of a ring-like structure of manifolds of states, are much more necessary and indispensable if we think about systems that actually code spatial angles, or code, let's say, angles of head movements in navigational neural systems, and so on. In these cases, which are more memory-like cases, which remember variables like angles, the only way that we know how to construct such memory systems is by generating such ring-like attractor using similar mechanisms. And there it's much more plausible a system like that actually occurs. Again, you have the similar flavor of a simple physicist idea about broken symmetry, which, however, where you take it down to a particular system which is experimentally measured and tested continuously, one of the most known systems, you find that in implementing such an idea in the reality of the brain, you have important constraints which you have to take into account. Otherwise, it's completely useless as a valid and a serious theory of the brain. And in doing so, in taking into account those different constraints, you come up with specific predictions, which then experimentally, you can engage with experimentalists in sorting out. So regardless, for instance, in this case, of the fate of this idea for primary visual cortex, I think it's fair to say that it's a model like that, and different models, but of the same nature, posed a very specific testable predictions, which experimentalists, some of them are trying, are engaged in testing, either because they strongly believe this is wrong, or some of them maybe believe that this is right. Regardless of that, this is a very fruitful area of an close engagement between experiment and theory. So, to close my talk, I focus here on a fundamental problem, and this is how stable states are structured in the brain. What are the nature of their manifolds, discrete states, how they relate to the vacuum states of the spontaneous activity, how you generate continuous manifolds of states, either by singular marginality and linearity, or by symmetries which are encoded into design of the architecture of the networks. The important issue is that in trying to think about how these hypotheses are implemented in the brain, we are trying, and to some extent successful, to come up with experimentally testable predictions, which is the key to a successful progress in the field. Thank you.
Recognizing angles, can you experimentally measure the rate at which changes in angle are recognized?
Exactly. That's one of the interesting predictions which for experiment. And this is that in this model, if you change the angle, not only there will be some underlying slow process going from one state to another, but also this typically what you'll see a transient wave or propagating pulse of activity from the one state to the next state. So what you would like to see that there are states in the middle, neurons in the middle, which will be transiently active when the neural system, the neural network, goes from this state to this state. This is an interesting prediction. So far, the experimental results are null. Those that looked at it claimed that you don't see this. So this is why, that's one reason to not in favor of this model, at least for primary visual cortex. And as I must confess, I think the odds are against this model for primary visual cortex, but there are other systems which for this model is much more is much a better candidate for. But again, the whole issue of what is the underlying dynamics of orientation selectivity from experimental point of view is only now is beginning to be explored. And the status of the field is that there are essentially experimental labs that claim that there is no dynamics in orientation selectivity. You put the stimulus on, and from the beginning, after some delay, you see a full-blown, sharp orientation response. There are other groups that claim that you see a substantial dynamics. You see maybe sharpening of tuning. Sometimes you see a change in the preferred orientation during the course of the response, and there is non-trivial dynamics which is the necessary signature of all these types of models. And the situation in general is not clear yet, but I believe that in a far future this issue will be sorted out. What experimentally do you see a non-trivial slow dynamics associated with visual processing such as orientation selectivity? So hopefully in the next meeting I'll tell you the resolution of this question and move on to other questions. Thank you.